Well, good morning. Thank you so much for welcoming me into this congregation. I really am enjoying the service, and I am very grateful to Eric, my brilliant colleague, for inviting me. I'm really touched to be part of this. I love that reading, and my tradition is Jewish tradition, and I was really moved to learn that welcoming the stranger is the most frequent commandment in Judaism. So I'm here to talk about my book, Milked, and the cover of the book is in this slideshow. I have these slides, they're mostly iPhone shots that I took on a trip to Mexico with a group of dairy farmers from Wisconsin and Minnesota. And I got interested in writing this book when my family and I moved to Mexico for a year during the Trump administration. In fact, Trump had just taken office when we decided it would be a great idea to get out of the country and live in Mexico for a year with our kids. So we moved to Oaxaca, and just as we were leaving, I saw a newspaper article in the Wisconsin State Journal. It was produced by Wisconsin Watch reporter there, Alex Hall, who traced the journey of a family that had been working on a dairy farm in Wisconsin for the last decade, and they had decided that with the ICE raids in their area and the increasingly stressful feeling that they had that their US-born children could be left at home if they were deported, if they were picked up for driving without a license, that it was time to go back. So they packed up their truck. The farmer who they worked for described it as a scene out of the Grapes of Wrath. They had kind of a rickety little wooden structure in the back of their pickup. They piled all their possessions in there, and they began the 3,000-mile journey back to Veracruz in Mexico. And it was reading that newspaper article that I learned for the first time that 80% of the labor force on Wisconsin dairy farms are immigrants, almost all of them undocumented, mostly from Mexico. They're almost all undocumented because there's no such thing as a year-round visa for low-skilled farm work. So this dairy industry in our state, the dairy state, depends 80% on the labor of undocumented immigrants and would collapse overnight if those people were gone. I found that fascinating, and I was fascinated that I had never known that. So this slide is the cover of my book. John Rosenau is the dairy farmer walking away, and Roberto Tecpile, who is from Mexico, is walking beside him. They're prominent figures in this book, which is a series of interlocking biographies of dairy farmers in the United States and the Mexican workers they depend on to do the labor on their farms. So I went to visit Luisa Tepole, who's a woman featured in that newspaper article in Mexico. I found the same truck her husband drove all the way from Wisconsin, parked on the street in San Juan Texhuacan in Veracruz. And Luisa is standing in her garden. The home that they built with the money they made milking cows is a very beautiful little home. They're raising vegetables and flowers in the garden, and you can see the clouds flying by at eye level in their home in the mountains there. She described what it was like for her two little boys who had grown up in Wisconsin to start school in Mexico, where the other children made fun of their Wisconsin accent speaking Spanish. She said it was a hard readjustment. But her story is a typical story of circular migration, which has been a tradition in Mexico since the Bracero program during World War II. Mexican migrants have come to the United States, worked for a while, made money. They don't have an American dream, they have a Mexican dream. They're making money to support that dream by working in the United States and sending money home to build homes and businesses in Mexico. So she was doing what many generations of Mexicans have done in working here for a while. But with the moral panic over immigration and the militarization of the US-Mexico border, people are spending longer and longer in the United States. It's much more expensive to cross. It's much more dangerous. And so in my book, there are many families who are in different stages of limbo, with Mexican children waiting for them back home in Mexico, or with US-born children who, as they get older, as their parents can't quite decide when to go back, when they knowing that they might never come back to the United States and want to make enough money to build the home and business they're building. Their children are becoming US teenagers and then US young adults. And the idea of going back to a subsistence farm life in Mexico, it seems like a more and more distant fantasy, even though their parents have been planning for that day for their whole lives. And that's the reason that they came. So it's a series of interesting situations. So my book is about two crises that brought together Midwestern dairy farmers and Mexican workers. And the first of these is the farm crisis. In Wisconsin, we've been losing 1 to 2 dairy farms a day, making us the number one for farm bankruptcies until recently. We dropped from 16,000 farms in 2004 to fewer than 7,000 farms today. NAFTA helped accelerate the get big or get out trend. And it was this same trend of farms getting bigger to survive and keep up with low prices that drove the hiring of Mexican workers. So one statistic that fascinated me that I learned in researching my book is that the number of farms dropped by more than half since 2004. The number of cows in Wisconsin stayed exactly the same at 1.2 million cows. The cows have just moved indoors onto bigger and bigger CAFOs. They're still there, but we have fewer and fewer farms. So when you drive through the Wisconsin landscape, you don't see these Holsteins, you know, dotting the fields anymore. You see big, large barns that are, you know, round the clock, indoor pastures, they call them, for the cows. The other crisis, of course, is the so-called immigration crisis. And this is not a crisis from the standpoint of employers in the United States, particularly farmers who are so dependent on undocumented workers. So it's a peculiarity that the rhetoric about immigration and the danger that immigrants pose to our country is so much at odds with the fundamental reality for the last two decades of our farm economy, which is heavily dependent, but also construction and food service and hospitality. Our economy is built around this dependence on undocumented workers who are coming here to fill a growing labor shortage. And so that is a peculiarity of our politics, that we don't recognize that. In Mexico, of course, people recognize that. And you know, everyone that we met in Mexico during their year there knows somebody who's working in the United States or have been here to work themselves. And the interdependence of our two economies is you know, dramatically obvious to them. Mexicans sent home $51.6 billion from U.S. jobs to help the Mexican economy in 2021. That's 4% of Mexican GDP. To give you an example, 3.3% of Mexican GDP is petroleum exports in this major petroleum exporting country. So it's a huge part of the Mexican economy, and it's a huge part of the U.S. economy, the work that these folks are doing. And so really, you have a group of rural people who are carrying the economies of both places on their backs. They are building homes, building streets and schools and businesses back in Mexico, and they are propping up major industries in the United States. A recent New York Times story, which you probably saw, about Central American children who are trapped in the United States through labor trafficking, unpaid, working around the clock, dropping out of school to do factory jobs, are making products for some of the most famous brand name U.S. corporations. They are packing Cheerios and Hot Cheetos. They are packing Fruit of the Loom underwear. They are underage workers, middle schoolers, some of them, working in the United States. And that article, which is about 2 weeks ago in the Sunday New York Times, I think really is a wake-up call for us to realize that we are living in an economy that is dependent on the forced labor of children. So puts the idea of the immigration crisis in perspective. It is a crisis for those folks who are here involuntarily, but it is also something that we have built structurally into our economy. So my book is really about the relationship of two groups of rural people who are under tremendous pressure. Because of the farm crisis and the get bigger, get out philosophy in agriculture, farmers were forced to hire workers for the first time. They had family farms. They were growing very rapidly. And they hired Mexican workers who moved over from local Christmas tree farms. And it's interesting to trace that oral history because it's recent. It's really in the last couple of decades that this has happened. So you can meet some of the first people who were involved in that transition. So I spent time with these farmers. And in the story that I learned, there's a wonderful Spanish teacher from a small town called Alma, Wisconsin, who was hired around 2000 by the local ag extension agent in that area to travel around and work as a translator on farms. And she helped farmers talk to their workers and workers talk to their farmers. And she started doing night classes in the Alma High School. So the farmers would come at night and try to learn Spanish, and the workers would come on a different night and try to learn English. They were exhausted. They were hardworking people, and they didn't do that well. She didn't feel like she was making that much progress. So she came up with the idea of taking the farmers on a trip to Mexico. And she took the first trip in 2001. And the farmers did a Spanish immersion program for a week. This is a picture of the trip that I went on in 2019. She founded a nonprofit called Bridges Puentes, and they go every year. They quickly drop the Spanish component, and they just go and visit the families of their workers. On that first trip, they had a free weekend at the end of the week, and so they went to a hotel in Orizaba, in Veracruz, And some of the workers' families came down out of the mountains to meet them. And the mothers of the young men who were working on the farms and grandmothers and wives hugged them, thanked them for taking care of their young men. And the farmers were incredibly moved by that experience. So they've gone every year since. Stan Linder, we just flashed by that last slide. Stan Linder is the person who I begin my book with, this man in front in the white shirt. He's driven his truck down there every year since 2001. He's a former long-haul truck driver. Beside him is Mercedes Falk, who now runs the Puentes Bridges nonprofit program, and Stan's girlfriend, Jillian, who came on the first trip. John Rosenau, who's on the cover of my book, is at the head of the table, and then I'm sitting next to him. And Carrie Schiltz, who's a member of a Lutheran congregation in Minnesota, had befriended a dairy worker in her area and came down to meet his family. So you can go to the next slide. The same group of farmers is standing here in front of the home of one of the workers, and they're just, it's amazing for them to see the transition over time with the money that their workers are sending. They have paved roads, they have built big houses, they've built schools. On the first trip, one of the farmers who I interviewed, Chris Weisenbeck, talked about how he arrived in San Juan Texhuacan and got out of the truck and saw all these neighbors working together to pour cement to build the foundation of a home. And he said he felt like he was walking into his own past in the 1960s in Wisconsin, that it was neighbors helping neighbors, everybody pitching in. And he said, small town Mexico, small town USA, same thing. There's this interesting sense of connection to an agrarian past among these groups of folks from Mexico and the United States who remember small farm life, who are under pressure from the same global economic forces that are out of their control and are figuring out a way to survive together through that transition to a much bigger industrial farm economy, but who have this kind of shared sense of respect for land, respect for taking care of animals. And it's, you know, it's an interesting cultural connection among these two groups of folks who otherwise seem pretty different. And the next slide, I have a picture of Stan, who's delivering a load of gifts from workers in Wisconsin to family members in Mexico. He drove an enormous quantity of stuff in the back of his truck that family members wanted to give to their friends and family members. When I was there, it was the polar vortex in Wisconsin. It was hot where we were in Mexico. And Stan got a call on his cell phone while he was standing in the garden of his employee Clara's home. It was mostly built. Beautiful home with views of mountains on all sides. She called because she couldn't start the trucks back on the farm because it was so cold and she needed help. So I just thought it was interesting how they had traded places. The next slide is Fatima Tepole, who's standing in the papeleria that she built with the money she made milking cows in Minnesota. It's a school supply store. There's a little school right across the street. I talked to the farmer who employs her on her cell phone. They stay in touch. There's a oil painting of cows hanging in her living room that he gave to her with kind of a screwy Spanish inscription on the back, thanking her for the time she spent working on his farm. He described how grateful he was to her and her brother for working on his farm and what a huge difference they made in his whole operation. They're hardworking people and he really appreciated them. Blanca Hernandez, who's good friends with Fatima, smuggled herself across the border 4 times, once in the trunk of a car where she almost suffocated. She worked in an airplanes parts factory in North Carolina, ended up coming north to work on Bill Trown's farm in Wisconsin. She's standing here on the left and her brother is in the middle, Mariano. He also came to the United States, put 2 or 3 kids through college working in the US. One is now a mechanical engineer in Mexico and one is a school teacher. Blanca teaches in a bilingual Spanish and Nahuatl school. So the indigenous Aztec language in her part of Mexico is Nahuatl. And she teaches really impoverished children and she has a real sense of mission to them. During the pandemic, she walked up into the mountains to their homes and helped teach them with school supplies that their parents didn't have to purchase. And these little kids are cutting coffee and working on the farm when they're not in school. So she had little sticks and leaves for their math lessons. And really talks with a lot of energy and passion about teaching those kids. That's what she's doing. After milking cows, she bought her car and her house, built her house with the money she made milking cows in central Wisconsin. And she got her place in the school system. So she has a you know, what's really the leg up for subsistence farm level Mexicans into the middle class is a teaching job. And she got that job by paying a friend who was retiring to take her position, which was a common practice in Mexico. Here's John Rosenau looking at the house that one of his workers was building. From the Mexican side, the economics of working in the US are very simple. One worker told me that he was making $11 an hour milking cows on a dairy farm, and he makes $20 a week in Mexico in a pallet factory. So the rate of exchange, the fact that the dollar is so strong, is what makes the lure of jobs in the US so powerful for folks there. Rosenau has said that when Donald Trump was saying that Mexicans are not sending us their best when they send people up here, he said that's absolutely not true. They are sending us their best when they send these young folks to work on the farms in Wisconsin, and that they are leaders of their communities. And he's so admiring of the way that they have become local employers and have made so many improvements to the village where they live. So I thought that was really interesting. Carrie Schultz, the Lutheran church congregant, this is the Marco family, I missed one. Here is John Rosenau outside of his employee Marco's house. These are Marco's parents. They live in a little wooden shack. His father burns wood to make charcoal for a living. They have 10 children. Marco came to the United States. He's in his early 20s. He's working on John Rosenau's farm. And by the time I finished writing my book, he had built his parents a big new concrete house, and he had built his own house. So they no longer live in this place. Carrie Schultz, the Lutheran Church congregant from Minnesota, in a very moving ceremony, the mother of the young man that she befriended in the United States gave her the traditional blouse that she's wearing here of the town where they live, and thanked her for being a grandmother to the grandchildren that she had never met. Okay, so here's the point in the presentation where I address the elephant in the room. The question that I always get, especially from East and West Coast media types when I talk about these farmers, is how they could have possibly voted for Trump when they're so dependent on undocumented workers. That's my next slide. But it hasn't advanced, but it's okay. You know, it's true that many of the farmers in my book are both passionate about their undocumented workers and were Trump voters. They voted for 2016, and rural areas of Wisconsin went even Trumpier in 2020. So we know that that's a phenomenon. There are various reasons for this. One of them that came up a lot in my conversations with farmers is NAFTA. People felt that Trump actually spoke to the raw deal that NAFTA was for farmers in a way that neither Democrats nor Republicans had been willing to do. That they felt that neither political party really has their backs, and that they're far away from national politics, so that there wasn't really so much a sense of taking responsibility for the president. They felt embarrassed by the anti-immigrant things that he said, but also felt that Washington was far away, and that maybe he would remember the forgotten men and women of America, as he promised. So I feel that the conversations that I have had with especially East Coast media folks about that really betray part of the problem, which is that the Democrats are waiting for rural people to just come, like, see the error of their ways and come around to voting for Democrats instead of thinking about what it would mean to really meet the needs of rural people. Can you advance the slide? I don't know if there. Yeah, that's the slide for this part. But the other thing about my book is that I felt like it was a bit of a break from toxic partisanship, because the people that I talked to had these intense personal relationships with the workers that worked on their farms, and a real sense of outrage about their being picked up for driving without a license, felt they should have a year-round visa to work on a farm, felt that they should be able to drive, and had a sense of personal connection that I think in some ways has to be the route to get out of our very siloed, toxic partisan times, that there is more to people than that 30,000 foot view of politics, which is a very grim and discouraging view. But underneath that, I found that there was a lot of warmth and a lot of willingness to be vulnerable. You know, vulnerability is our theme. To try to learn Spanish when you're 70 years old and take a trip to Mexico and try to figure out another culture is not a small thing to take on. And so seeing that willingness to move and to try to understand other people, I found actually quite hopeful. So I feel like we need to think about the ways in which we are all in the same boat. All of us are affected by our increasingly consolidated food system, the loss of land, the polluted water that we're suffering because of big CAFO farming here in Wisconsin. food insecurity that is a side effect of our increasingly stretched out food system and the unreasonable demands that this economy makes on both workers and farmers. In my chapter on the future of farming, I travel to the largest dairy farm in the United States, Fair Oaks Farms, which is a kind of factory farm funland. They milk 36,000 cows, and they have a tourist destination in Indiana where they run tour buses that have pictures of cows on the side and pictures of pigs on the side, and you can see their mega operation. It looks very clean. They have a Smithsonian level exhibit on feeding the world by having larger and larger production on land. So they ignore the chemical inputs involved in that and the soil erosion involved in that and just talk about sort of the miracle of modern farming. There was a huge scandal in 2019 when some animal rights activists infiltrated their dairy operation and took video of abuse of little cows, calves, who were brutally abused by the workers there. And because of that scandal, Coca-Cola separated itself from Fairlife Milk. Coca-Cola bought Fairlife Milk, separated itself from Fair Oaks Farms as a producer of Fairlife Milk, because McCloskey, who's the person who created Fair Oaks, invented patented the method for making ultra-filtered milk, which is what Fairlife Milk is. So that scandal caused them to separate from this particular farm, but the bigger issue remains, and that's just a dystopian view of perpetual growth in farming. And they actually have a display that encapsulates that, which is basically a labor-free dairy at Fair Oaks. You go to this dairy, it's a big factory floor. There are no people there at all. There are cows with tags in their ears, so the tags automatically open gates and get them into the robotic milking stand where they're milked by a robot. There's one employee in what looks like an air traffic control tower. She has an iPhone. She gets an alert on her phone if one of the gates gets stuck and she can go down and fix it. But otherwise it is labor free. So this is a very grim view of the future of farming. After visiting Fair Oaks Farms, I drove south to Kentucky and visited the great agrarian writer Wendell Berry, who sort of put that all in perspective. He talked about what we are losing when we lose our contact with the land and with a smaller scale of agriculture, understanding where our food comes from, having an ethic of stewardship, understanding that we have limited resources and we need to take care of them. So that's kind of where I go in my book. And I felt an interesting connection between Wendell Berry and his philosophy about land and care for the land, that being sort of leading to a more humane care for people. Luis Ray is an economist who lives in Oaxaca, who we got to know when we were living there. And he speaks in a way that's very similar to Wendell Berry about preserving local culture, preserving local economies, trying to give Mexican migrants an alternative to leaving the country to make a living and sustaining indigenous culture, language, and art and crafts. He was the first person in his family to go to college and is an economist and teaches at the University in Oaxaca. He speaks Zapotec, and he was visited by a US economist. So he tells an anecdote about a US economist who came to visit him to do field research in Mexico. And he came back from interviewing shopkeepers in Oaxaca, very excited, reported that he had discovered the root cause of poverty in southern Mexico, and it was a lack of ambition in the people. Because he had interviewed these shopkeepers and said, do you want to have the biggest shop in town? Do you want to have two shops? You know, what are your dreams? And they had said, we're fine where we are. You know, we close at 4, have coffee with our neighbors. It's good enough. It would seem greedy to our neighbors if we tried to grow too big. And so Luis Ray turns that anecdote on its head and talks about how, in fact, that should be a model. In a world with limited resources, we need to have a more sustainable economic model, and also a model that values human beings more. He calls it the economy of human dignity, that, you know, we need to rethink what we're doing. So I see a real connection between that philosophy and sort of that struggle and the struggle of farmers here in the United States, and the way in which we all need to sort of plug into what's happening in our food system and how it affects us. It's not just those rural Trump voters, it's all of us. It's fundamental to our survival. So in a way, I guess my point is we're all vulnerable. We all wanna pursue happiness and meaning, community, survival, and we need each other to find our way. So thank you.